Hi, I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is your Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of August 9th, 2013. So nice to be with you today. The past few weeks, we went back to personal finance basics. We gave you boot camps in saving, investing, and dealing with credit. Well, now that we're caught up with the fundamentals, let's pay some attention to the most fundamental part of the equation in personal finance. That's you, the consumer, and how you navigate challenging financial and commercial nightmares like these.
Well, one of the issues I've had with Cablevision was bad reception from time to time. They've handled it pretty nicely. Like, you just call them up, you tell them what your issue is, they try to help you. We really haven't had any money taken off of our bill because the problem has been resolved the same day.
All right, so I bought a ticket on Travelocity, and then what happened was that they couldn't validate the bank transaction. So what they did was they canceled my itinerary. And they made me call them, and I was on the phone with them for 3 hours or so. Unfortunately, I couldn't go on my flight. As a compensation, what they gave me was a $100 voucher.
And that was Justin and Manny. We met them on the streets of Manhattan. A lot of times, resolving a problem comes down to this. How much time are you willing to spend dealing with it? It's one thing to make complaints. It's quite another to do something about them. A year and a half ago, the federal government took this on when it established the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or the CFPB. It helps people resolve problems and writes legislation to make the overall consumer experience easier. In July, Congress confirmed Richard Cordray as director of the CFPB, and he joins us now. Welcome to Marketplace Money, Richard.
Thank you.
Well, I imagine you there in Washington sitting on a mountain of complaints. What are the most common ones that consumers have?
And by the way, it's a growing mountain. We were just talking about the fact that our first month we had about 600 complaints. Last month we had 13,000, and the volume continues to grow. Anyway, there's a whole variety of things people are coming to us about. Obviously, many ways in which consumers feel that they weren't treated right or weren't treated fairly, and part of our job is to see that consumers are treated fairly.
What kinds of disputes are considered by your organization? Do you just deal with conflict resolution between banks and their clients, or is it much broader?
So we deal with consumer complaints in a range of areas. So any kind of complaint you might have about your mortgage, or if you're having a problem or an issue with a debt collector, as about 30 million Americans currently are, or if you have a problem on your credit report or something that seems wrong or you can't get corrected. In all of these areas, we're taking complaints and working with people to get them resolved.
And how does that process of filing a complaint work?
So you can initiate it a number of different ways. You can call us on our hotline, 1-855-411-CFPB. You can send something to us through the mail, or increasingly many people come directly to our website at consumerfinance.gov. It's a pretty transparent process where you can follow the progress of your complaint online. We will work with the company. We'll work with you. It doesn't have to be a bank. We also benefit tremendously by having these complaints because it gives us a real picture of what consumers are concerned about, what kinds of problems they're having across America, which is invaluable, so valuable that we have created a consumer complaint database to make that information accessible to the public as well. So that's something you can look at if you're interested on our website and get a sense of what kind of complaints have been filed against what companies, what kind of resolution they got.
Well, in your experience, what are the hardest problems to solve?
Well, definitely mortgages have been the hardest kinds of complaints to process because, first of all, they're often very complicated problems. They may have built up over years. They may involve lots of money, tens of thousands of dollars, even hundreds of thousands of dollars. So those are obviously big complaints and big problems, hard ones to deal with. Sometimes the consumer just want an explanation. They just want to understand, and they want to have the respect of having somebody tell them what happened and why it happened.
Well, here's a strategy question. When you're registering a complaint with the CFPB, is it wise to let the company or the institution know that you've done so, kind of a deterrent effect?
I think it's fine to do that. They will know immediately because one of the first things we do with a complaint is take it to the company and work with them to see whether it's valid and if so, whether it should be resolved and how. We will also work with you and give you a chance to take a look at what has happened and whether that's satisfactory. But I think it's fine to bring it to the company's attention. In fact, in many cases, you may want to start with the company, then come to us, but you can do it either way.
Well, not that I think we need to inspire people to complain to the CFPB, but can you share a story of a successful consumer resolution with us?
You know, I actually would disagree. I think we should be encouraging people to complain and speak up. For too long, consumers have had to just swallow mistreatment or times when they thought they were treated unfairly or times where they felt they didn't get the respect or the attention of a company. You know, there used to be a saying that the customer is always right. I mean, it was never factually true, but it represented an attitude, and we want businesses to put their customers first. You know, we're now coming around full circle where we're hearing from consumers on our complaint line where they're telling us about the successful resolution of their complaints. So we're starting to hear back, interestingly, from consumers. And, you know, sometimes they're satisfied, sometimes they're dissatisfied.
And does any one story stand out in your memory?
The satisfying ones are people who say they weren't treating me like a person. They wouldn't pay attention to me. There was one woman I recall in particular for whom the credit report showed that she was deceased. And she said, you know, obviously I'm not deceased. I'm very much alive, but I can't get them to fix the problem. They've got me confused with someone else. And the real satisfaction people have when they finally get the attention of someone and they get their problem resolved and somebody took the time and paid attention and helped them.
Richard Cordray is director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Barbara. Appreciate it.
You can find information on how to contact the CFPB on our website, marketplacemoney.org. Heard the CFPB Director Richard Cordray say mortgage disputes are the most challenging complaint for his agency to resolve. Building a housing market that's fair and easy for consumers to navigate has been a recurring topic in President Obama's recent remarks on the economy. This past week, in a speech in Phoenix, Arizona, the president announced his support to replace government-backed mortgage lenders Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. He says an overhaul of the mortgage system will help prevent another housing crisis.
One of the key things to make sure it doesn't happen again is to wind down these companies that are not really government, but not really private sector. They're known as Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae.
So what would phasing out Fannie and Freddie and creating a privatized mortgage industry mean for consumers? Elise Glink is an author and an expert in personal finance and real estate. Hi, Elise.
Nice to be here.
So tell us exactly what Congress is weighing.
What Congress is trying to figure out is how do you still provide a regulated mortgage market where anybody who wants to buy a home is guaranteed to find that there's money available for them, but at the same time, not have the government take on the $100 billion risk that it has taken on and actually had to shell out for during the recent housing crisis.
Well, the Senate has one proposal and House Republicans have put out something else. What's been proposed and how could that affect buyers going forward?
It's interesting. What's been proposed is from the right or the Republican side of things, they would like no government backstop, basically. They don't want the taxpayers on the hook for dollar one. On the other side, the Democrats, they're looking for some sort of a government backstop, but nobody wants to be at the place where there's a $200 billion with a B that's on the hook from the American taxpayer because that's bad for reelections and it's bad for our government and it's really bad for people who actually have to pay for that, like you and me. Even though Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were publicly traded institutions, right? So they had shareholders and they had highly paid executives and all the rest, they were still quasi-governmental, meaning that they had to live up to certain kinds of rules and regulations that other corporations don't have to live up to. And so if you move this all into the private sector, which is what the Republican proposals are all about, The question is, how do you make sure that these companies that don't have to be quasi-governmental are actually going to do good for the American people?
Well, no matter what comes, it looks like the smart thing to do is anticipate higher mortgage rates, right? But how much higher?
How much higher? That's the big question. I think we're looking at a couple of different pieces. So there's the baseline mortgage interest rates, which are going to go up as the economy improves. I mean, let's face it, we were only at a 3.5% 30-year fixed because our economy was in dreadful shape, and it's still in pretty bad shape. So the economy improves, interest rates go up. But if you've got to pay for this government backstop, that's going to be an insurance policy, and it's going to fluctuate, and it's going to be expensive, and ultimately it's going to be homebuyers that pay for that.
Who is most affected by this news? Will the shift toward a privatized mortgage industry mean anything for current mortgage holders, or is it people who want to refinance, or is it purely about people looking ahead to get a mortgage?
I think if you have your loan and you're not doing anything with your loan, you're fine. This isn't really going to affect you. It is going to affect anybody who wants to refinance, get a home equity line of credit, a second mortgage, or actually go out and buy a house and use financing. I think it could also fragment the market quite a bit more than it is. And I think it could make it tougher for people to qualify for mortgages. And this is one of the reasons why the industry is not of a single mind. They're very nervous about anything that would change the status quo. Nobody wants home buyers to go away. And if these new rules translate into new mortgage rules and it's tougher to qualify for a loan, that could deeply affect the real estate industry's pocket.
It's hard to imagine it being tougher to get a loan than it is already.
Oh, no, you've forgotten. Back in 2008, even if you had millions in the bank, nobody could get a loan. So it used to be even harder than it is today. And I think the pendulum is swinging back to something a little bit more reasonable. But the problem is all of us in our head measure this against where we were in 2003 and 2004, where if you had a pulse and a good credit score, you could qualify for a loan that was 10 times your income. And frankly, those days aren't coming back, and I hope they never do.
Personal finance expert Elise Glink, thanks so much for this.
It's a pleasure.
To a new report, I'm told that you're probably not listening to this show in your car. And I mention that because researchers at the University of Michigan claim that fewer Americans are driving or even owning cars these days. Maybe that's because consumers are fed up. The Consumer Federation of America says cars are the number one thing we gripe about, according to their top 10 list of consumer complaints. And here to talk about why our autos make us so angry is Lynette Kalfani-Cox. She's an author and personal finance expert, better known as the Money Coach. Welcome back to Marketplace Money, Lynette.
Thank you, Barbara, for having me.
Okay, my first thought, you know, those of us who do drive spend so much time every day in our cars. So that's why we complain about them so much, right? What do you think about this brilliant and original theory?
Well, I think it's not only reflective of the amount of time that we spend in our cars, but the amount of money that we spend on them. So consumers feel, and I think rightfully so, cheated if something goes wrong with their car, particularly a new automobile, that they expect to be up to snuff.
Okay, well, what are the most common complaints you hear from car owners?
I mean, certainly it can range from performance issues to problems with the engine to safety-related concerns about brakes and, you know, maybe gas pedal that don't work properly, things of that nature. And I think those are serious. But even if someone's, you know, window doesn't roll up or down the way it should be, or the top on a convertible, say, is sticking or not shutting and opening properly, that's cause for concern as well.
You know, I'm sticking with my theory, Lynette. You didn't budge me. I think it's because it's so annoying to deal with these, you know, little complaints every day. But say I own a lemon, you know, a car that's constantly in the shop. How does the lemon law really help me, and what legal recourse do I have?
Unfortunately, a lot of consumers aren't really aware of their rights under state lemon laws. State lemon laws are geared toward the buyers of relatively new cars who've made what most state laws call a reasonable number of attempts to get those problems fixed. And reasonable is typically defined as 3 or 4 times. Well, when the problems haven't gotten fixed to the customer's satisfaction, you actually have a number of areas where you can get recourse, financial recourse, due to having a lemon car. One of them is that you can get a cash buyback of a lemon car. And that's, in essence, getting back all the money that you spent on the car, your down payment, the trade-in, tax, license fees, etc. All of that you can get back. You can also do something that's called a swap for a new car. In essence, you exchange that lemon vehicle you purchased for another car. And it's typically a MSRP for MSRP swap, meaning it's kind of like a trade without depreciation. And then lastly, you can also get cash compensation for whatever defect has shown to be regular and recurring in the car that you purchased. So people really should look into it if they feel that a car hasn't been performing, is defective, and is giving them serious ongoing problems. Among state lemon laws, there's something called a fee shifting provision. And in a nutshell, it means that if you had to sue somebody, which obviously means you had to go to court, take time, and pay an attorney to represent you, then you can get your legal bills paid for, again, under the state lemon law. Really, you'd be suing under those scenarios the manufacturer, not the dealer. The dealership is sort of just the middleman. But you'd be suing the dealer because, in essence, you'd be saying, under law, I really sort of didn't get what I paid for, which is also reflective of your rights under a federal law dealing with lemon vehicles. And that law is called the Magnus-Moss Warranty Act. The good news about that one is that it actually also covers used cars, not just new cars, which is most applicable for state lemon laws.
Well, Lynette, I hope you can stick around because we actually have some callers with questions about cars and questions in general about personal finance. So you ready to take some calls?
I am indeed. Let's do it.
That's great. Dean is on the line from Virginia Beach. Hello, Dean.
Hey, how are you doing?
Yeah, welcome. Good. So I see you're in the market for a new car because your daughter got her learner's permit?
Well, I'm in the market for another car. Yeah. So she got her learner's permit, and we are a one-vehicle family, and that is a large SUV. So I'd like to get something smaller for her to learn it.
Now, before we get to the car question, how are you holding up? Because I just taught my second teenager how to drive, and I have the gray hair to show for it.
It's going fairly well. There's moments where the knuckles are starting to turn a little white. But overall, it's not going too bad. But that's part of the large SUV thing.
That's a challenge for a teenager.
Yeah, that has too much power and can be a little hard to park sometimes.
Right. Okay, so what are you looking for in a second car for your daughter? And I imagine for the rest of the family to use too, right?
Yeah. I'm just looking for a small SUV, like a 4-cylinder SUV. And I'm really torn between a new and a used car because used cars seem to be rather expensive. I'm really just looking for something that's very safe and very reliable, something that's going to last me 5 or 10 years because it'll be a second car for me to use as well.
Gotcha. Okay, and you like your SUVs, it sounds like.
Well, I need something to be able to put surfboards and stand-up paddleboards on.
We're getting somewhere. Okay,
yeah,
I have a picture of what's going on in your family. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So, Lynette, what should Dean be looking for?
Well, given that he wants this car, A, for the family's use, and B, for his teenage daughter's use, I would not recommend a new car. If you're trying to save money, in essence, believe it or not, the cheapest cars overall to insure are minivans and sedans. Now, good luck trying to get your teenager to drive a minivan, so you won't want that. The sedan option actually is probably, from a financial perspective, will be your cheapest option. But I just want to highlight one other point. Because you have a teenage daughter who's just gotten her learner's permit, I assume she's probably right around 16 years old. And
yes.
Unfortunately for us, and I say us because I'm putting myself in that boat as well, my daughter turns 16 in 2 weeks. Unfortunately for us, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety says that 16-year-olds are the single most dangerous set of drivers on the road. As a result, it probably will come as no surprise to you that your insurance rates are going to shoot up, likely dramatically. So it's not at all uncommon, once you add a teen driver to the mix, to see your insurance premiums go up by double, triple, or in some cases, even quadruple.
Lynette, though, doesn't it help that this is a daughter we're talking about? And don't grades also, good grades, figure into the equation as well for many insurers?
They do indeed. Overall, however, even though statistically teen boys have more accidents than do teen girls, it's still the case that 16-year-olds overall and teenagers in general have obviously less experience behind the wheel and therefore higher rates of accidents. And it's everything from them, again, not having the skill set and the experience, but also things like texting and driving, unfortunately, being distracted, drivers behind the wheel of a car. The fact that she has a learner's permit, obviously, to start is a good thing, because right now she'll be able to get some of that experience under her belt, and she can only drive with an adult in the car with her. So you'll be able to monitor some of her habits. But there are some ways to offset those expected rising insurance premiums you have to pay. And yes, good grades is one of them. Your daughter, if she has a 3.0 grade point average or better, typically insurers will give a discount for that, often a healthy discount, 20 to 25% or so. Whatever type of vehicle you buy, you emphasize that you wanted something safe and reliable. That's smart, because safety features also lower your auto insurance premiums. So you'll want to get something with anti-lock brakes, with, you know, automatic seat belts, with airbags, things of that nature. And there's two other ways, though, that you can lower your overall cost with your teenage daughter. One is have her to take a defensive driving class. A lot of insurers will give you credit in the form of a lower, premium for that. And then also, it sounds like she's only going to be driving the car, you know, sometimes. So, and it'll be mainly for family use. So if that's the case, you can also ask about what's called a low mileage discount. Maybe, for example, she only will drive the car, I don't know if she has a job or not, but if she only has, say, a weekend job, and maybe she drives the car to and from work, then her time behind the wheel will be limited. So you might be able to get a low mileage discount as well.
Dean, does that help you out? That was a load of info.
No, that does. And she is a very good student, and she's not concerned with speed right now. So
that's all
she's
great.
Into the utility. So I think she's on my side with this.
Well, good luck to you, and safe driving for you and your daughter.
Great. Thank you very much.
Marketplace Money from APM. Lynette Calfani-Cox is with us today, answering your questions about money. And earlier in the show, we heard about potential changes coming to the mortgage business. But the inevitability of higher mortgage rates isn't stopping some folks from going on a house hunt. Amy in San Diego is one of them. She hopes to be a homeowner soon, but she's a little stumped by the process, and she's on the line now. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Lynette and Barbara.
Hello there.
Hi, Amy.
Hi.
So what do you do there in San Diego?
I am a Chinese language teacher.
Oh, you teach Mandarin?
I do.
Okay. Ni hao?
Is that right? Well, hi, hao. Good job. Good job.
I've exhausted my Mandarin. What made you want to jump in and buy a home? Tell us.
Well, I've been wanting to for quite a while. I moved back to the country, back to the U.S. from China, about a year or so ago, and I was a little upset that I missed the really good time to buy a house in the U.S. So I feel like I want to get into the market before the rates go back up, especially in San Diego, because it's kind of a hot market and inventory is really limited right now.
Yeah, and tricky. So do you have a specific question for Lynette?
I do. Yeah, Lynette, so my boyfriend and I are trying to find our dream house, and we've already started the process a little bit, and we've gone to a mortgage broker. But that's only because my friend also went to a mortgage broker, and he had a good experience with that. But I'm just wondering if we should go to directly to a bank or look at other options for our loan instead of to a mortgage broker.
Well, there are pros and cons to using a mortgage broker to help you secure a mortgage. The biggest advantage is that a broker can shop around in the marketplace for you and can field any number of potential mortgage products from a variety of lenders. If you go direct to a bank, they're obviously going to try to sell you essentially on their particular loan products. So the broker widens the scope and the field of possibilities for you.
But Lynette, now, Amy has to do her homework too, right? Not just trust the broker?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I'm assuming that she's worried about having to pay the broker certain fees that
right.
you know she
yeah,
might
I'm
not otherwise.
About those fees.
In all honesty, the fees can be slapped on at any point in the process if you go direct to a bank or if you use a broker. And in a lot of cases, they'll say the word fee at the end to sort of signal that this is just some almost optional kind of fee that they've, you know, slapped on or tacked onto the process. An application fee, you know, a loan processing fee, an underwriting fee, a mortgage review fee, things of that nature. Those are the things that you should look out for, regardless of whether or not you're going direct to a bank or using a broker. There's some fees, of course, that you're just not going to get around because this is part of the business of them making loans and you obtaining a mortgage. And so you'll have certain legal fees, you'll have title fees, you'll have insurance fees, transfer taxes. But I think the overall thing that I would emphasize is that you should get your disclosures up front. Initially, when you apply for a mortgage, a lender is supposed to give you a good faith estimate. And so they should give you that GFE, as it's called, to tell you, very clearly, here are the fees that we expect you to incur in this mortgage. And then you can take one or two or three even and comparison shop among different lenders or even among different brokers and see where the fees all stack up. On the back end, once a loan is closed, you'll get something called a HUD-1 statement. And you should do a very close comparison and look at what they told you up front in terms of the good faith estimate versus what's finalized on the back end with your HUD-1 statement and reconcile the two. I mean, there can be some little, you know, charges that are slightly above perhaps what was quoted or within a range, but you shouldn't see all new fees introduced on the HUD-1 statement or you shouldn't see a doubling of fees, things of that nature.
And Lynette, just quickly, do you have any advice on finding a responsible broker? Because I've bought houses, my experience buying houses with and without brokers is that in a very difficult legal climate, which we're in now in buying a house, that some brokers, they just know so much more. I mean, it's as if you have a lawyer in your pocket helping you buy the house.
Right. I think referrals are one good source of information, certainly. And I think that you mentioned that you had a friend, Amy, who did, in fact, refer you to a broker. A lot of times having a trusted relative, friend, a colleague, someone that you know who's actually used a given person's services and having them sort of vouch for it is one of the strongest recommendations that you could possibly get. I, too, have used both a broker, a mortgage broker, and have gone direct to banks. And frankly, I was satisfied in both cases. So I think it's a matter of personal preference. Some people go directly to the bank that they're currently doing business with. And I would sort of caution you against that as just sort of a default position. Some people think if they, whether or not they're making a new purchase or even a refinance for an existing mortgage, they'll just automatically go to, you know, XYZ Bank if they have a checking account or savings or if they do some other business there. I think you should broaden your horizons, though, and not automatically make the assumption that an existing bank or mortgage company is going to always give you the best deal. You really do need to shop around.
Okay.
Amy, I hope that helps you out.
All right. Yeah, it really does. Thank you so much.
Great. Good luck on your house hunt. Thanks so much for reaching out to Marketplace Money. And all of you listening, you can get in touch with us, too, with your questions. You can ask us about student loans or home loans or car loans or whatever's on your mind. Just write to us at marketplacemoney.org. Lynette, it was great having you with us.
Thank you so much, Barbara. I'll have to come back on soon.
Oh, I hope so. It was lovely. Lynette Kalfani-Cox is a personal finance expert. You can find a link to her site, askthemoneycoach.com, at our show page, marketplacemoney.org. And thanks again, Lynette. It was such a pleasure.
Thank you, Barbara.
For next week's show, we'd love some financial advice from you, too. We want to know what lessons you learned about money from your parents. And if you have children, what words of wisdom are you passing down to them? Tell us about your experiences with money and parenting on our website or on Marketplace Money's Facebook page. $250 million can buy you the Cezanne painting The Card Players, or about 150 Lamborghinis, or, as we all learned this week, one of the nation's last remaining leading newspapers. I'm referring, of course, to the purchase of The Washington Post by Jeff Bezos, owner of Amazon. Now Bezos can try to solve the problem everyone else in journalism is desperate to figure out: how to get people to pay for news. Some, like the New York Times, require a subscription to access online articles, and others, like yours truly, Public Radio, ask for contributions, as you well know. But how do consumers decide what price they're willing to pay? And how can news organizations get them to pony up the cash? Andrew Bojan is a media reporter for Pointer, which operates on the donation model, by the way. Andrew, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What do we know about how people calculate the value of news?
Well, it depends what they're getting from news, is what most media organizations have found. One company that's really interesting to look at is Gannett, which owns about 80 daily newspapers in the U.S., and it's rolled out paywalls at all of them except one, USA Today, which delivers national news. What they've found is that people have proved willing to pay for digital subscriptions to their local papers, which often do the kind of in-depth reporting that few local media outlets can do. And in fact, in every quarter since the fourth quarter of last year, circulation revenue has grown while advertising revenue has fallen at Gannett.
So that's what's behind this hyper-local idea for the news, that people will pay for that, but maybe they feel that they can get their international news everywhere else on the web.
Right. They feel that that's more of a commodity, that that's something that they can get for free either from an international site or a big American newspaper.
Well, I'm wondering if consumers have a cost-benefit analysis then when it comes to news. And is part of that a sense that being informed is an investment, that it has worth?
Yeah, I think that there's been an increasing awareness among consumers that there's just no other place to get this stuff often. And it can be as simple as, you know, news from the local high school, football, or City Hall. And those are the places that are really hard to cover. They require intensive reporting, and newspapers are really the only places that can devote people to them. One site that I'm fond of citing as sort of the end of the paywall debate is the Weekly World News, which is the home of Bat Boy, and it put in a paywall in January, and it so far seems to be working. People have to have Bat Boy, so, you know, if you want it, you're going to have to pay.
Well, that leads into my next question, which is how successful paywalls are.
There's been different experiences at different media companies. Digital First Media, which operates a lot of local papers, has found its results to be somewhat disappointing. And the New York Times has found that circulation revenue has replaced print advertising revenue.
Well, Bezos is known as an innovator. So what new ideas might he try out with the Post?
That is the question everyone has been asking this week. He told the Post himself that he has no plan at the moment, which I think for a lot of newspapers would be a terrifying moment. But I think when you're talking about somebody like Jeff Bezos, he's proven to be a very patient owner.
Well, I know we're in the area of speculation now, but one idea, of course, that's been floated is whether we're going to see something akin to the Kindle single model with individual articles or series of columns from Post writers, kind of a newspaper-view idea.
Right. That's something that a lot of newspapers have had some success with. They'll turn long reporting projects into ebooks. You might not get somebody who wants to pay $3 to $10 a month for digital access to your newspaper, but they might pay a dollar for something that they're really interested in.
Andrew, can you tell us something about what you've been willing to pay for your news?
Yeah, I actually live in the Washington, D.C. area, and I subscribe to the Washington Post on Sundays, which gives me digital access through the week. And I also subscribe to the New York Times on Sundays for the same reason.
No Bat Boy.
No Bat Boy, no. No, but I've been tempted.
Andrew Bojan, media reporter for Pointer. Thanks so much for talking today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, another part of our life that's moving online, customer service. Next time your cable goes out, instead of working your way through the inevitable phone tree, you might want to try social media. Kim Beasley is a social media strategist, and she's gotten some fast results this way. Good to have you on the show, Kim.
Thanks for having me.
Let's lay down some basic ground rules. When should consumers use social media rather than, say, make a phone call or write an email to solve a problem or get faster service?
If they have tried the phone and they've tried the email and they're not getting through, I would definitely say take to social media.
You have to do your research first, though, right? Not all companies are very active on social media.
I totally agree. One of the things I do is I go to their website and I look to see what social media profiles they share on their website.
And are the response times so much better on social media or, say, on Twitter or on Facebook?
I believe so. I have a friend who actually was having experiencing problems with her Comcast internet service and she couldn't get to them. So I got on Twitter. I sent a message to Comcast. I immediately got a response. They direct messaged me and we sent private messages. We got her problem resolved and she was back up and going. That to me is great customer service.
Well, you know, we all want what we want and we want it now, particularly when it comes to things like cable or your internet connection or central air. But what's a reasonable amount of time to expect a response from a company when you're using social media?
If I don't receive a response within, say, 30 minutes to an hour, I try to find them in other places. A company that is hard to find on social media probably is not mining their social media presence. Therefore, you would have to resort to telephone and emails.
So when you don't get a response, say in a few hours, that's the nuclear mm-hmm. option to...
The nuclear option I've had to take, unfortunately. I had a really bad experience with the company. When I canceled my contract with them, they decided to bill me an unreasonable amount, and I was on the phone all day for almost 24 hours, it seemed, not getting answers. And so finally, I took to social media and I explained what happened to me, and I did it in a positive way. And at first, they said it was going to take me 14 days to get my refund back. And after me writing a post about it, it took only 24 hours to 48 hours to get my refund.
Wow. And this is on your blog, I'm assuming, this post?
Actually, it was a post on Google Plus and Facebook.
Well, a lot of our listeners wrote in and said that they got a great response rate on Twitter.
Twitter is a really great place. It just depends on where the company is focusing their social media efforts.
Ah, okay. I've heard people talk about the art of the complaint. Can you describe it for us? Give us some tips.
You know, my mother always told me growing up, you can win more with sugar than you can being sour. So one of the first things I always tell people, if you have a complaint and you need to get a point across to a company, be as sweet as you can. But make sure you state your point and make sure you're clear about it. Once you do that and you really hit your target, then watch for their response. And the way you handle it determines your outcome.
Now, there is another side to this, and that's using social media to shame customers who, for instance, don't tip well. And there have been ongoing controversies over this on Facebook and blogs with restaurant servers and delivery persons. What's your take on it?
I think it's a shame on that company. It is not a good excuse or a good reason to shame a customer. If you choose to shame a customer, that degrades you, not so much the customer. You know, there may be a little bit of backlash from them, but it looks really bad on you as a business when you shame a customer.
Kim Beasley is a social media strategist. You can find a link to her company on our website, marketplacemoney.org. Thanks so much, Kim.
Thank you for having me.
And we have some more tips on how you can use social media to get better customer service. Just visit our homepage, marketplacemoney.org. Spent the past hour looking at you, the consumer, you and your buying power, how you interact with companies, and the role of Uncle Sam in helping you get a complaint resolved. There's another thing the Fed does, which is inextricably linked to your life as a consumer. And that brings us to our latest edition of Money Mystery.
Mortgage-backed securities.
Look what Scooby found!
To keep the level of yield in your portfolio constant.
What do you think it means?
Subsidized, unsubsidized.
I don't know, but something tells me we'll soon find out.
Now Jordan Goodman, editor of MoneyAnswers.com, explains the ins and outs of the cost of living adjustment, or COLA.
The idea is that when people receive some kind of benefit, it should be adjusted annually to keep up with the rising cost of buying necessities. COLAs apply to salaries and employment contracts, pensions, and government entitlements, the biggest of which by far is Social Security. Right now, with official inflation rates quite low, COLAs have been adding maybe 1 or 2% to what people get each year. Even so, that can amount to billions of dollars a year for something like Social Security. Right now, the COLA that Social Security recipients get is based on annual changes in the Consumer Price Index, also known as the CPI. One proposal floating around Congress these days is to change that COLA to what's known as the chained CPI. The chained CPI updates the weighting of each of 211 different categories of goods and services in the CPI each month to account for people's different buying patterns. So, for example, if the price of apples goes up in a month and people buy more oranges instead, then the weight of orange prices will be boosted while the weight of apple prices will be reduced. So COLAs may sound like they account for a relatively small amount of money, but because they're applied so widely to so many kinds of benefits, they add up to really big bucks.
Jordan Goodman, editor of MoneyAnswers.com. Have a money mystery you'd like solved? Head to MarketplaceMoney.org and we'll get on the case. This week, the government released new travel figures. Roughly 22 million Americans have traveled overseas so far in 2013, and they've been spending their money in places like Europe, the Caribbean, and the Middle East. In fact, the Middle East has seen a 6% rise in American travel for the year. But also this week, we got a warning. The U.S. State Department has issued a worldwide travel alert through the month of August. Let me repeat, worldwide. We are to be cautious about going anywhere. Duluth. Down the Jersey Shore, Cairo. What the heck are we supposed to do about such a vague warning? George Hobica joins us to make sense of puzzling travel alerts now. He's the founder of AirfareWatchdog.com. And welcome back, George.
It's a pleasure to be here again, Barbara. Thank you.
Well, first, to clarify that it's serious news, what prompted this new alert and the closure of nearly two dozen embassies and diplomatic missions?
The chatter was that something was going to happen, that Al-Qaeda in Yemen had made an edict that to make an attack. I think we have to realize, though, it's just an alert. So travel advisories from the State Department, travel warnings, travel alerts. I was a bit confused. So actually, the travel alerts and the travel warnings are all under the category of a travel advisory. A travel alert is actually less serious than a travel warning. A travel alert is actually a shorter period. Usually it has an expiration date. Travel warnings sometimes are in effect for years. And I don't know if a lot of people know this, but there's a travel warning to Mexico that's been in effect for quite a while.
Well, okay, but you can't always anticipate when or if a country will end up on the State Department's list. So what should you do if you find that you are holding a ticket to a location that is on the advisory?
Right. You can't anticipate this. So some people get travel insurance. The problem with travel insurance is it's not going to protect you against a travel alert or even a travel warning. If there's a terrorist attack that has happened within 30 days of your expected arrival, then under most travel insurance policies, you can cancel. There are cancel for any reason travel insurance policies. They cost about 25 to 50% more in the premium, and you have to cancel within 48 hours or more ahead of your trip.
Okay. Well, do the airlines have any responsibility to customers who are ticket holders during an advisory?
Airlines are not going to let you cancel your non-refundable ticket because of a travel warning or travel alert. Obviously, if you have a refundable fare, then you can cancel. I noticed a few days ago the fire in Nairobi. For example, British Airways did allow people to rebook to any other destination of their choice.
You're saying that as if you were a little surprised they did it.
I was surprised. I think it was pretty good of them. But because British Airways could have said, well, you could go next month. So once in a while, when you see a disaster like that, you will see, even if it's a terrorist attack, you will see the airlines rebook people to other destinations or allow you to get your refund.
Well, let's say you're planning a trip to a country on or maybe near the warning list countries. Dare I ask, is that a good way to score a deal?
Actually, not usually, because I remember a couple of years ago in Thailand, there was a lot of civil unrest, and I expected to see fares to Bangkok go way, way down. Well, they didn't, actually. What Thai Airways did and other airlines did was they took their planes and they rerouted them. So they took the planes off of the Bangkok route for a period of time, and then they used them on other high-demand routes. So I've never seen airfares go down, unfortunately, when there's an incident.
George Hobica is the founder of AirfareWatch.com. Always a pleasure talking with you. Thanks
and
for this.
And same here. Thanks, Barbara.
And if you need something to keep you company while you're traveling, you're in luck. All this summer, we're asking our friends in finance to share some of their book picks.
Hi, I'm Robert Brokamp, a certified financial planner and senior advisor for The Motley Fool, the author of The Motley Fool's Guide to Paying for School. And the book I'd like to highlight is a book called The Talent Code by Daniel Coyle. And the reason I think it's a good book is because I think one of the most underappreciated aspects of financial planning is building your human capital. That is, building your career, your skills, your network, what you can do in the marketplace to earn a good salary and guarantee as much as you can that you'll have a job. The great thing about The Talent Code is that it gets into the brain science of building skills. A lot of people think of talent as a natural ability, but really it comes down to hard work, deep practice, strong motivation. And this book gives all kinds of hints on building your own skills, but also if you're a parent or a teacher, it's a great resource.
Hello, my name is Natalie McNeil, and I'm the author of The Frugalista Files, How One Woman Got Out of Debt Without Giving Up the Fabulous Life. My summer book recommendation is Why Good Girls Don't Get Ahead, But Gutsy Girls Do. 9 Secrets Every Career Woman Must Know. The author is Kate White, the former editor-in-chief of Cosmo. I read this book in college, and it gave me lots of tips and strategies on how to develop my career and how to take risk. If you're a woman, particularly a young woman, who's always worried about being liked or being nice, you must pick up this book. This book gives you tools and strategies for how to make smart decisions at work and develop your career. Great career means great money.
And you can find the entire list from our reading series on our website, marketplacemoney.org. Just click on the summer reading link on our homepage. Listeners are sharing their choices as well on our Facebook page. Walter suggests You're Broke Because You Wanna Be by Larry Winget. And that'll do it for Marketplace Money this week. Next time, financial lessons from mothers and fathers.
My dad basically would just tell me that not to spend it unless I had it and think wisely about what I'm purchasing, but also to have a good life. I mean, not just be on a budget.
Send us your stories of money and parenting. You can reach us on Facebook or at marketplacemoney.org, and you can always keep up with the show on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch and Nancy Fargali, with Lindsay Foster Thomas, Daryl Perinata, and help this week from Raghu Manavalan. Chris Clark is our engineer. Deborah Clark is the Marketplace Vice President and Executive Producer of the program. I'm Barbara Bogave. Thanks for listening, everybody. This is APM.